I will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cortizo-Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Here.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Here.
Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley.
Present.
Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Thank you. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Liz Lagarde.
Liz Lagarde, present.
Representative Lucero.
A ray of sunshine, Madam Chair, not Dick Tracy.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Richardson. Representative Tice.
Here.
And I'll call again Representative Dabney.
Dabney, present.
Thank you. And Representative Richardson. A quorum is present.
We have a quorum present. So first up, we have the approval of minutes from the February 17th meeting. May I have a motion?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Olson moves approval of the minutes for February 17th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Right. The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 17th, 2021 are approved. All right, we've got three bills on the agenda today, everyone. And first up, we have House File 8. I will move that House File 8 be recommended to be in finance. Members, please note that we will be limiting our discussion today to Section 2 of the bill as it pertains to the Commerce Committee. Representative Liebling, welcome to the committee, and please describe your bill.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing House File 8 today. So House File 8 is a step towards simplifying our public health programs by taking back the prescription benefit that's been contracted out to multiple managed care organizations. A similar plan is in the governor's budget, and the jurisdiction of all of that is in health, finance, and policy. But it is Section 2 of the bill that's before the committee today. And that section simply directs DHS to develop recommendations for expanding the purchasing program to enrollees of health plan companies who would contract with DHS to participate. So the commissioner of DHS is directed to present the recommendations to the chairs and ranking members of the Commerce and HHS committees by December 15, 2023. So members, there can be no question that the high cost of pharmaceuticals is driving up healthcare costs, and more of that cost is being shifted to patients. And I'm not going to go into all of that today because I know you're very familiar with that. The reason that Section 2 is in this bill, and this is a piece that's not in the governor's budget, by the way, but the reason it's here is because I believe we need to explore the strategy of using the state's purchasing power to drive down prices. We've seen the pharmaceutical industry fight us on just about every other thing we try to do to get our arms around prescription prices for our constituents. And this is really a critical issue. So this tries to see if there's a way that we can use our purchasing power as a state. Market-based solution, we're in the market too, and we could use our bulk purchasing power to buy down the cost of pharmaceuticals. So all this section is doing is asking DHS to develop a recommendation. Now, the recommendation could be, doesn't work, we're not doing it. That's possible. All we're doing in the bill is asking for a recommendation. So with that, Madam Chair, that's pretty much all it is, and I hope members can support it.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Liebling. So you do have a few testifiers with you today. Are we going to take testimony first, or should we move to the amendment? What would be your preference, Madam Chair?
Well, Madam Chair, it's not my amendment, so, you know, that's up to the chair. And the testifiers, although I'm aware that some people wanted to testify, I don't know, maybe it would make sense to go to the testifiers.
All right. It looks like Vicki Cunningham is here to testify.
Yes. Hello. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and state your name for the record.
My name is Vicki Cunningham. I'm a past Medicaid director for the West Virginia Pharmacy Program, and I'm here to talk a little bit about the West Virginia Medicaid carve-out experience. We carved out our program in July 2017 after an actuarial study that we had a possibility of saving $30 million for the Medicaid program and also putting $34 million back into the pharmacy community in the form of dispensing fees with the carve out. So we proceeded to do that within a 3-month time frame. That was a compressed time frame, but I did submit some written material, so I won't belabor many of the details, but I will say that we did make sure that we had all of the prior authorization information from the managed care companies. We had a year's history from the PBMs, and we made sure that clinical care coordination would continue as we moved all of our members back into the fee-for-service program. We also stress-tested our system heartily to make sure that there wouldn't be any disruption in care for our patients. So at the end of the year, we found that we had saved $54.5 million and put $120 million back into the pharmacy community in the form of dispensing fees. Those were $10.49, as mandated by our state plan and approved by CMS for fee-for-service pharmacy. The average dispensing fee from the PBMs had been 59 cents. So there were several good things that came of the carve-out. First of all, our community pharmacies were very pleased with the dispensing fees and felt that it allowed them to stay afloat. We paid them, of course, the 1049 dispensing fee, plus we used a cost-based system for drugs based on the national average drug acquisition cost or the lower of several other algorithms, which were approved by CMS. So pharmacies were guaranteed to receive at least what they had paid for the drug. Our prescribers were happy because there was one prior authorization help desk that they needed to contact, one number to call and one number to fax, and prior authorization criteria was enforced across the board more equally, so it made it much easier for our prescribers. Our pharmacies, of course, were happy with the solution, and our members were able to get all of their prescriptions from one pharmacy. What we had discovered in West Virginia is that many of our Medicaid members were going from one pharmacy to another to get their medications because pharmacies couldn't afford to dispense certain classes because of lower reimbursement from the managed care companies. So overall, we felt that we had a very positive outcome for our Medicaid members and continue to have our carve-out in place. Another advantage that we had was that we had one source of truth for rebate files, so our rebates increased because we received those rebates back from pharma manufacturers in a much more timely manner, and the files were much more accurate, and no drugs that were not eligible for rebate were dispensed by our pharmacies because our system rejected those. We also felt that our clinical coordination of care increased because, as I said, our members could get all of their prescriptions from one pharmacy. And also, we opened up a clinical portal for managed care coordinators so that they could look in that portal at any time of the day and see what their members had received. And we provided a written report to each MCO at the end of the day. There was some pushback from the managed care companies about clinical care coordination. So that was the way that we addressed that concern. I know there's some concern from 40B pharmacies, and I've worked with other states, and there are ways to address those concerns if that should ever be a problem. But overall, our carve-out experience was a very positive one for our members, our pharmacy providers, and our medical providers. We experienced no disruption of service as we moved down this path. And as I said, we did it in a compressed time frame. We did it in 3 months. I might not recommend that for other states, but it can be done if you need to do that. And I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time or any time that the chair deems is appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham, for being here today. Members, I do see a couple of hands raised. Just for the interest of time today, we've got a number of testifiers on this bill. So we're going to take testimony first, and then we will shift to member questions.
Madam Chair, this is relevant.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comments are relevant to the testimony. Our scope, we were told, is in Section 2, and the multiple minutes of testimony that we heard were really affecting Section 1 with Medicare and Medicaid. So I'm just wondering if we're expanding the scope to include Section 1 or if you're going to be screening testifiers and holding them to Section Number 2. So I do know a number of Minnesota organizations that would like to have testified on Section 1, if that's in scope. And if that's the case, perhaps we could lay the bill over till we can give those folks a chance to get on the testifying list as well. So I'm just asking kind of procedurally where we're heading on it, because, again, we spent several minutes talking about something that's out of the scope of what we were told we should be talking about in Section 2 today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. We will be keeping our focus on Section 2 of the bill, and I appreciate those comments. Next up, we have Sarah Durr. You introduce yourself and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As stated, my name is Dr. Sarah Durr, and I am a pharmacist here in Minnesota, and I serve as the executive director at the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. Thank you for hearing this important proposal that Minnesota Pharmacy believes can make a difference in patient lives, generate stability for providers, and save the state and taxpayers millions of dollars. House File 8 would eliminate the managed care and commercial pharmacy benefit managers from management of medical assistance drug spend and move to direct fee-for-service drug spend model. Currently, there are 28 states that have implemented this direct fee-for-service Medicaid drug spend model, an additional 12 that are looking at this model as well. Today, Minnesota has 75% of the MA drug spend managed under PBMs through the MCOs. As mentioned, recent studies of Medicaid managed care programs in Ohio, New York, and Pennsylvania have indicated that PBMs are overcharging taxpayers for the services in Medicaid managed care, reimbursing pharmacies at a lower rate, billing the state Medicaid program at a higher cost for medications, and retaining the difference. The promise that PBMs are going to save states money has not been realized, and in fact, based on the 2019 Minnesota Management and Budget Fiscal Note and the current savings for this proposal in the recently released governor's budget, we know that the state, Minnesota citizens, and healthcare providers will do better under this model. We support HF8's premise and promise. However, any move to 100% fee-for-service model will also need to account for patient access and provider compensation. Relying on transparent, reasonable, and mutually agreed on provider reimbursement will keep the patient's best interest in mind, and that will be essential for the success and efficient drug spend for the MA population.
Mr. Remind you and ask you to keep your comments to Section 2 of the bill as it applies to the Commerce Committee today.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have one other comment, as mentioned, is just the concern with the 340B savings. And we want to make sure that our health systems and pharmacies are healthy and able to sustain patient care in that realm. So thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'll be here for the remainder of the hearing of this bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you again for asking the testifiers to keep their comments and testimony to Section 2 of the bill. Again, I'm hoping that other testifiers are going to stay to this, because I just want to re-underscore what I had said before, that there are a lot of other providers in Minnesota who are not given the opportunity to testify today because Section 1 is more within the scope of theirs. And in fairness to the public process, I think we want to make sure that we get on top of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. And this bill will be moving over to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, so there will be ample opportunity for future testimony. Today, we'll keep it to section two. Minnesota Association of County Health Plans. Can you introduce yourself and state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I am representing the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans, MCHEP. For over 40 years, the Minnesota County Health Plans have delivered outstanding health care coverage to hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans. Currently in 22 counties that are part of IM Care, Prime West Health, and South Country Health Alliance. Another 11 counties have joined Prime West and are going to begin delivering care in 2023. MCHEP is concerned about House File 8 and the proposal for the Department of Human Services to create a pharmacy benefit and prescription drug program. While we understand today's hearing is focused on Section 2 of the bill, it is impossible for us to see how you would pursue that without first creating a prepaid medical assistance pharmacy benefit carve-out proposed in Section 1. First, moving pharmacy benefits will limit healthcare options and responsiveness. It will negatively impact healthcare outcomes for enrollees. Coordinating both the medical and pharmacy benefit creates optimal and effective coordination of care, and continuity of care improves health outcomes. Fragmented care drives poorer health outcomes and increases the total cost of care. The state of New York attempted a statewide carve-out and has ended up moving benefits back to the plans after unintended consequences and savings were not achieved. Second, projected savings from this proposal need to be carefully analyzed. This includes a thorough review of the methodology used to determine those savings. The state would need to spend significantly more money on new IT capabilities and staffing, and it is important to understand those costs. The experiences of the 13 other states suggest that Minnesota should be cautious. We appreciate these authors' amendments and the effects to find solutions to increase costs. We share her concern for sustainable strategies. However, we have serious concerns this proposal will negatively impact coordination of care for Minnesota Healthcare Program enrollees and will not save the money as hoped. We believe the approaches proposed in House File 8 require a good deal more study to accurately determine impacts of healthcare outcomes and overall costs. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We look forward to working with you as we continue on this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Next on the list, I have Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Mr. Andreessen, please introduce yourself and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 8. I'll kind of echo Mr. Griffin's comments that, I'll try to stick to Section 2, but the two sections do kind of interrelate. The council is concerned about the approach of a carve-out pharmacy benefits from Minnesota healthcare programs. In large part because managed care is the most effective when care and utilization management extend across all healthcare services. And we're concerned about the likely increased cost of this approach given the experience of pharmaceutical carve-outs. And much of this is due to seeking of rebates, which tend to have a lower reimbursement for generics versus for brands. Now, under the carve-out approach, we've seen other states use a lower percentage of generic medications and instead negotiate for more rebates on a per-prescription basis for brand drugs. And this rebate maximization strategy typically leads to a higher average net cost per prescription. In Ms. Cunningham's testimony, it was mentioned that West Virginia saw savings from a similar carve-out. However, there has been separate analyses that paint a different picture. An April 2019 report from the Menges Group found that administrative savings were significantly less than promised, and Medicaid costs per prescription rose 12.6% compared to the average U.S. average of 4.1%. And this is much due to the part of higher utilization of brand name drugs. Additionally, DHS's systems are not at the level for up-to-date care coordination as cited by West Virginia. Starting in 2019, all managed care organizations were required to adopt DHS's preferred drug list across all state public programs, and we've seen this movement away from generics to brand name drugs. As this bill moves forward, we'd like to see a greater analysis of the fiscal impacts of this proposal, especially if we include Section 2, but more importantly, talk to the state public program enrollees and consumer advocacy groups to hear how this change has impacted them when it comes to enrollee cost sharing and access to prescription drugs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Finally, I have Peter Fjellstad from the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Mr. Fjellstad, please correct me if I've pronounced your name wrong and introduce yourself for the record.
No, Madam Chair, thank you. Everybody in Minnesota pronounces it right. Thank you, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Peter Fjellstad, and I'm Senior Director of State Policy for Pharma, a trade association of 33 biopharmaceutical manufacturers that make brand name medicines that save and improve lives every day. Today, I respectfully oppose House File 8, which creates this prescription drug purchasing program for the state's Medicaid and Minnesota care populations, and specifically to Article 2 today. It would require the commissioners of DHS, MDH, and Commerce to develop recommendations for the purchasing program to include individual commercial lives who have purchased individual coverage from a health plan that has contracted with the DHS commissioner to participate in the program. Now, let me be clear. Pharma does not oppose bulk purchasing in the non-Medicaid populations. It's been spoken at the hearing today that this is a carve-out similar to what West Virginia done or other states such as Ohio. However, this bill actually combines lives. It combines medical assistance, which is our state Medicaid program, with an Article 2 Minnesota care lives and the intent in Article 2, in the intent in Article 2 individual commercial lives, which is in violation of federal law. First, Minnesota does not have the authority to require Medicaid rebates for non-Medicaid populations, either in Article 1 or Article 2, if there are no Medicaid expenditures. Second, Medicaid may only be leveraged to obtain rebates for non-Medicaid populations when doing so benefits that Medicaid population as a whole or increases the efficiency or economy and economy of the Medicaid program. Third, Minnesota's burden to show that combining Medicaid and non-Medicaid lives that it will meet CMS requirements is tremendous in terms of resources and costs. So without funding, it's unclear how DHS will be able to complete the necessary research and identify how the proposal will sufficiently benefit Medicaid populations. If the concern in this bill is to address prescription drug access for Minnesotans, this bill does not do that. The medication assistance tool, www.mat.org, as provided in a handout today, offers more than 950 programs for patient assistance for patients that can't afford their programs. And so in closing, Madam Chair, I'd just like to reiterate that the combination of Medicaid lives with other lives, whether they be Minnesota care or commercial lives, has never been done successfully in any other state in the country. Thank you for your time, and I ask you for a no vote today.
Thank you, Mr. Fjellstad. Representative Haley, you have had your hand up. Thank you for your patience. Would you like to ask your question now, or would you like to wait until after the amendment?
I could ask it now, because I'd actually like to ask it of the woman who spoke from West Virginia.
Very good. Please go ahead.
A couple of things. My understanding of the West Virginia Medicaid model is that they actually were paying 59 cents, I think, for a dispensing fee. And at that point had pharmacies that did not want to serve Medicaid patients. And therefore, you know, that crisis was created where they had to make a change. So maybe she can just address that situation. But also, I'm concerned about the impact on 340B and how critical access hospitals that serve our, you know, very important populations would be impacted by this legislation, and she spoke to some of that. So I'd like to ask her if the savings were actually passed on to patient care for those populations, if she can address those questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Ms. Cunningham, go ahead.
The 59 cents was an average dispensing fee. Sometimes it was $1.09, sometimes it was zero. That was just an average. So it was very difficult for pharmacies to stay afloat when sometimes they weren't reimbursed for the cost of the drug, let alone the low dispensing fee. So that did lead to a lot of complaints. I'm not sure that's what led to the actuarial study that was done that led us to do a carve out, but we did have many complaints from pharmacies. The 340B issue was not a large issue. In West Virginia, we don't enroll contract pharmacies. So 340B pharmacies in West Virginia are required to bill at actual acquisition costs or the 340B ceiling price, whichever is lower. So those savings were not passed on to 340B. However, we didn't move any physician dispensed drugs or clinic dispense drugs to the program. We only include a point of sale drugs. In other states, I know this has been an issue, and other states have found ways to work around that to make sure that 340B clinics do not lose the amount of spread that they had, that they were using in their clinics.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Representative Haley, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Ms. Cunningham, for that explanation. I guess since the bill author is using the West Virginia model as a reason that this proposal would be successful, I am concerned about that. As you state, your situation in West Virginia is dramatically different than what we have in Minnesota. We have many critical access hospitals that rely on the 340B program in order to serve the underserved populations that we count on them to serve. And that is my main objection to this bill, that we would be in a dire situation because of the impact on the 340B reimbursement. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Chair Liebling, do you like to respond now or wait until after the amendment?
Just really briefly, Madam Chair, and thank you. I didn't ask Ms. Cunningham to come, and this isn't my model. And if you, you know, I'm here today with Section 2, and, you know, that's what this committee needs to pass on. And I know there's a great interest in this more broadly, and we will certainly discuss those issues in the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Very good. Well, let's move. Additional member questions after that. So Representative Rasmussen, you have offered the A4 amendment. Would you like to move and describe your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. First off, I want to thank Representative Liebling for her bill today and her tireless work on healthcare policy. While I do have concerns with House File 8, I sincerely appreciate Representative Liebling bringing her pharmacy benefit carve-out proposal to our committee today. As stated, this was one of the Blue Ribbon Commission's recommendations and has been pursued in other states as a means of controlling the costs of public health care programs. So I think this is a timely and important discussion for us to all be having. The A4 amendment requires DHS, in consultation with the legislative auditor, to report on the fiscal impact of this carve-out for the state. The amendment gives DHS 18 months from implementation of this program to report on the fiscal impact. This would give them at least 12 months of data and an additional, you know, 6 months for additional data or time to analyze the data as a part of their report. The fiscal report would be paired with the recommendations on expanding the state PBM to private plans that Representative Liebling has in Section 2 of her bill. The only downside I see for Representative Liebling is that the recommendations would be delayed from December 15th, 2023 to 18 months after implementation. I think that delay is well worth it. Before we look at potentially expanding the state-run PBM to private plans, we should know if the carve-out is saving the state money. If there are significant savings, I think this fiscal report will underscore the success of today's proposal. If the fiscal report shows underwhelming savings, then we can reevaluate. And so I hope Representative Liebling will consider this as a friendly amendment. And thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, for the discussion today. And with that, I will move the A4 amendment and would request a roll call.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. To the author of the bill, Representative Liebling, do you have any comment?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask members to oppose the amendment. If the amendment was just about having pushing out the report date a little bit, that would be something I would be certainly willing to consider and will consider, frankly, as it moves to the next committee. However, what this amendment is doing is basically saying our fiscal note process isn't good enough. And I don't know, Representative Rasmussen wasn't here when the legislature not that long ago created the Legislative Budget Office precisely because some legislators didn't trust the budget process or the fiscal note process in the executive branch. So we have this kind of newish agency that makes sure that our budget process or that our fiscal notes have validity to them. Frankly, I don't think we even need that process. But what this amendment is doing is asking for yet another process, going to the legislative auditor for a methodology. And I do sit on the Legislative Audit Commission, so I know a little bit about the legislative auditor, and I would just say that this isn't his role. This isn't the office's role. And we do have a process for getting fiscal notes. We don't have it yet. After the forecast, we will have an updated fiscal note on this bill, which we will hear in the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. So I think that this is just not workable. So I would ask members to vote no.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Members, any discussion to the A4 amendment? I see Representative Lucero has his hand raised.
Oh, Madam Chair, I can wait until after the bill. It's not to the, I'm sorry, after the amendment.
Thank you.
Perfect.
All right, Representative Rasmussen, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. I appreciate that there's a lot of different work that's done to analyze the fiscal situation of different proposals that come before the legislature. I do think that just given the gravity and the importance of this proposal and also the complicated nature of establishing a baseline, it makes it necessary to have a separate report done by DHS in consultation with the legislative auditor. And I think we've actually heard some of that come out today, where we've had Ms. Cunningham has talked about the savings. We've had others come and with other reports and question those savings. And I think it's because the baseline is really complicated here, right? We're having moving targets. And so I think a special report that would come along with the recommendations would help us make a better decision on not just evaluating having a state-run PBM, but also if we should expand it out to private plans. But I appreciate your consideration today and would ask members to support the amendment so that we know if this program is saving us money before we expand it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. And Representative O'Driscoll, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I encourage a yes vote on this as well. As we can see, the narrow scope and the strike zone that we were given on this bill, section number two, we actually had to talk about section one to be able to make section two make sense, because without section number one, section number two can't exist. And I think it's very important that the Commerce Committee ask the question and deal with it, because pharmaceuticals are within our scope. And again, as Representative Liebling pointed out, it wasn't all that long ago that we ended up doing some pharmaceutical and pharma benefit reforms here in the legislature. And I think additional data to our body is extremely important into the legislature, particularly when we're talking about a complete wholesale change of how we want to dispense and pay for medications for all of Minnesotans. I think it's a drop in the bucket of information that we can have. And I'm sure that many of you will be supporting this along with Representative Rasmussen and myself on this, because you know how important it is to make sure that the laws that we pass are important. The laws that we pass have consequences, and the laws that we have passed have their intended consequences. And this amendment by Representative Rasmussen goes right square in that direction. So thank you so much, Representative Rasmussen. And again, I encourage a yes vote on the A4 amendment to House File 8. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Lucero, we're waiting until after the amendment vote?
Yes, after the amendment, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification. All right. So any further discussion to the A4 amendment before we move forward? Hearing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson. Vice Chair Cortez Watun.
No.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yes.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Daphne.
No.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Haley.
Yes.
Representative Cagle.
No.
Representative Lee.
No.
Representative Lilly.
No.
Representative Lislegard.
No.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Farr.
Yes.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson.
I understand that our first grade teacher who-
Representative Tice.
Aye.
And I'll call again, Chair Stevenson.
No.
And Representative Richardson.
With 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Members, Representative Lucero has had his hand up, so any discussion to House File 8, Section 2. Please go ahead, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my question is to the bill author. Chair Liebling, in regard to the expansion of the purchasing program that you are proposing, can you speak to the IT system that would be required to help administer this? Is it going to be an existing system? Is it a new system? Can you just speak to some of those details, please?
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for that question, Representative Lucero. It's a great question. I would hope that would be part of the recommendation that the bill is calling for, because certainly this would be, you know, if this was something that was feasible, that would absolutely have to be something that would be considered. So the bill is only, Section 2 is only asking for a recommendation. So do I know what it would look like? Absolutely, I don't. And as I said it in my introduction, this may turn out to be a big fat, we can't do this. I don't know. All the bill is doing is saying, let's see if you can give us a recommendation, and if you note that the recommendation for what to do is to allow entities to voluntarily contract with the state to take advantage of this buying power. So it's not forcing anybody to do anything. It's just saying, give us a recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And members, I will
just a quick follow-up, Madam.
Make a final reminder to keep our comments or questions to Section 2 of the bill. Representative Lucero, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think my question was, I don't know if you were directed at me or somebody else or others, but my question, I think, pertains to that. So the follow-up would be to Chair Liebling's point there. What always starts out, there's a long history. What always starts out as voluntary participation over time, generally speaking, migrates to a forced or coercion by government or else. So just keep that in mind, Madam Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not going to ask the bill authors any questions, but I am going to share some observations. This bill is about to put Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, in front of people and their pharmaceutical benefits by passing this, if this were to become law. The gatekeeper would now be the state of Minnesota to decide when, where, how, and at what price people would be receiving pharmaceuticals in the state of Minnesota. I don't know that that was a founding principle of this country and of a capitalistic idea with free market. Yes, we do need to shore up some things in our marketplace, but this absolutely puts the state of Minnesota in control of one of the most important things that people need, their pharmaceuticals. And if you vote yes for this, you're saying, let's clear the way for the state of Minnesota to tell you as Minnesotans what's important and what's not important for you in the way of your drugs and what price point you're going to pay. I'm going to give another big fat idea on this to model after what Representative Liebling said. I think this is a big fat. We shouldn't be in this business of doing this, and we shouldn't be putting the state of Minnesota as the gatekeeper between Minnesotans and their pharmaceuticals. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Members, any further discussion to House File 8, Section 2 today? All right, Representative Liebling, I will give you the last word.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion. And I just would remind members that what we're talking about here, first of all, is public programs, So we've taken our public programs and over the years we've split them up into multiple entities, and then providers, especially, for example, pharmacists in this case, have had to deal with multiple entities, multiple payers for what is essentially one program. And I just, anyway, I'm not going to belabor this, but it's just the idea that getting a recommendation suddenly results in a parade of horribles. I think what this bill is about saying we want to find some solutions. We need some solutions for the high cost of pharmaceuticals, and let's find out whether there are some possibilities out there. And if you're voting against this, I guess you don't even want to know, because we need solutions and we're all struggling to find them, but you can't find a solution without asking some questions. And that's all Section 2 is really doing. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Hearing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 8 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Fatisa-Witoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
And I'll ask again, Representative Haley.
No.
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails and House File 8 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance. Chair Liebling, you are on your way.
Thank you so much, members.
Okay, members, next we have House File 633, Representative Beer.
Madam Chair, sorry, I had a little sound out there. Did you say to proceed?
Perfect. I will move House File 633 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance. So now, Representative Bierman, please go ahead and describe your bill.
Fantastic. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Members, it's no secret that healthcare costs, including the costs of prescription medications, continue to be a challenge for everyone. Patients, providers, insurers, and policymakers alike. We hear from our constituents every day about these challenges. They want us to work towards solutions that get to the core of these problems, but they also expect us to look for relief options where possible. HF 633 helps provide relief to people on the individual and small group markets who face costly monthly prescriptions, and does so with a minimum impact to the health insurance market. My bill would require plans in these markets to offer products that have copays on all prescription drug benefits, with the highest drug copays capped at 1/12 of the annual maximum out-of-pocket amount. These copays are pre-deductible, so the plan member doesn't have to write a check of several thousand dollars before coverage begins. This benefit offering is just like your local utility, allowing you to spread out your natural gas expenses over a full year. Patients still pay fully for the prescription benefits they're using over the course of the year, but without the heavy burden of thousands of dollars in upfront deductible and co-insurance costs in January and February. This same benefit policy has worked well in Colorado since 2016 and guarantees that people whose lives and well-being rely on access to costly medications find individual and small group coverage that makes their monthly drug bills more manageable.
The difference in premiums is modest, typically a few percentage points, and is borne only by those people who choose to buy the copay-only product. Meanwhile, the insurance market in Colorado has shown no negative impacts from this regulation, and consumers are able to find products to meet their needs. Turning our attention to the text of the bill itself, HF 633 would add a new subdivision to Minnesota statutes, which sets our essential health benefit package requirements for health insurance. Lines 1.8 to 1.17 of my bill refer to the individual and small group markets, respectively. Each segment requires that health insurers who do business in these markets must make sure that at least 25% of the plans they sell include a copay-only prescription drug benefit. The 25% requirement is consistent for all coverage levels, bronze, silver, and gold. Lines 1.18 to 1.20 define the highest allowable copayment, 1/12 of the annual maximum out-of-pocket payment for an individual. Now, in many cases, this is a high payment still, but it's better than a deductible plus coinsurance. Lines 2.1 to 2.6 clarify expectations for how insurers name and market these products. If consumers cannot count on being able to easily identify which products contain the copay-only benefit, it will be harder for them to find their way to these products if preferred, or away from these products if not preferred. Likewise, these products should be available to all individual and small group customers and should be advertised alongside the regular slates of products available for purchase. Finally, members' lines 2.7, 2.8 establishes that these products will be available as of January 1st, 2022. Members, I ask you to take a look at your packet and please note the large number of endorsing organizations for this bill. It has widespread support because it will bring relief to patients. Now, Madam Chair, would like the committee to hear from a couple of testifiers, if we can proceed to them.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Before we get to your testifiers, would you like to discuss your author's amendment?
Oh, yes. I would like to make that part of this as well. The author's amendment is a clarification of the exception.
I will move, Representative Bierman, I will move your author's amendment labeled A21-0035. Please go ahead and describe it.
Oh, so it's a clarification of the exception of catastrophic plans and HSA plans.
Members, any discussion to this amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the A21-0035 amendment is adopted. Representative Bierman, you may go ahead and introduce your testifiers.
Sure. I would like to first have Dr. Brian Arnold, please proceed.
Mr. Arnold, please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brian Arnold. I'm a licensed pharmacist from Plymouth. I have 16 years experience with the most recent 6 years in Minnesota. In 2016, I became a specialty pharmacist with a focus in oncology, particularly bloodborne cancers. As a specialty pharmacist, I provide services including side effect management, drug utilization review, and most importantly, proactive adherence programs, including a top barrier to medication access, elevated and potentially unpredictable patient out-of-pocket costs. I'm here today to support House File 633 to make the already high out-of-pocket costs for patients more predictable. Medical advancements have produced medications that are absolutely amazing. There's no denying these treatments extend life expectancy while maintaining a high quality of life. These meds also come with a huge price tag. I see firsthand how hard it can be for patients with specialty disease states such as multiple myeloma, a bloodborne cancer, to cover their prescription costs. One cycle of the oral medications to effectively treat a bloodborne cancer such as multiple myeloma is upwards of $25,000 per month without insurance coverage. The initial out-of-pocket cost for most insurance plans includes the entire deductible and a copay on top of it. In January of each year, the resulting out-of-pocket costs range from $2,500 to $5,000. I will leave you with a closing scenario. Most plans reset your deductible at the first of every year. Imagine you or a loved one are diagnosed with a disease requiring a high out-of-pocket cost in the second half of the year. Are you willing to pay the deductible at the end of the year to turn right around and pay the full amount again in January? Or do you delay treatment of a life-saving medication until after January 1st to simply manage costs? This is a conversation I have every year between oncologists and newly diagnosed patients. The scenario is real. Vote yes for House File 633 to evenly level out the out-of-pocket costs throughout the year for Minnesotans. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Next on the list, we have Monica Tice. You could introduce yourself and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Monica Tice. I live in Robbinsdale. I'm a paralegal and a mom to two wonderful college girls. I am a 28-year cancer survivor and a volunteer with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I would like to tell you my story and explain my support for House File 633. In the summer of 1992, after my freshman year in college, I was diagnosed with stage 3 Hodgkin's lymphoma. In 2004, I was diagnosed with stage 1 breast cancer, in 2011, stage 3 breast cancer, and in 2015, stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, which is currently not curable. As we all hear, prescription drugs are expensive. My deductible is just over $5,000 this year. In order to get my medication filled from the specialty pharmacy, if I have not met my deductible yet for the year, I have to pay up front. There have been years where my medication costs $12,000 for 1 month. And so in order to get that filled, I need to come up with the $5,000 of my deductible. And so for me, like a lot of people, it's due all at once. And so what do? I empty my accounts and I put the rest on a credit card. This isn't ibuprofen that I need, it's a cancer medication. And having a predictable, manageable cost could help patients like me manage this considerable burden. I'm fortunate that I have something that not all cancer patients do. I have an employer that asks me what my health insurance needs are every year and takes that into consideration when choosing our plan. My employer gives employees a set dollar amount every year to either put towards our office plan or to go out onto the individual market. What I appreciate most about House File 633 is that people like me need options, and this bill gives us options. If you don't want or need this type of prescription drug benefit, you don't have to buy it, and it doesn't affect you one bit. But if you're like me who's living with cancer, and I will for my lifetime, or others with other chronic diseases, who need more affordable drug coverage, this bill gives us options and the ability to manage our costs without sacrificing our care. Cancer is hard. It's really hard. And the financial toxicity makes it even more difficult. This bill can help to alleviate some of this burden so patients can plan for their expenses and focus on their treatment every day. Please vote yes on House File 633. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your experience with us, Ms. Tice. Next on the list, I have Dana Bacon. Could you introduce yourself and state your name for the record, please?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dana Bacon. I live in Rosemont, and I'm the State Government Affairs Director for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. A 2018 Colorado regulation with similar requirements to House File 633 gives us a real-world look at how prescription copay plans work. As you can see from the letter in your packets from Colorado's Division of Insurance, this policy has been helping consumers without hurting insurers. Colorado consumers have had no problems finding bronze, silver, and gold plans with copay and non-copay options. The price difference for copay products is small, between 0 and 8%, depending on the insurer. Consumers who choose these copay plans are no more likely to drop their coverage than other consumers. Just like we heard from Monica Tice, consumers want to have these choices. Finally, copay plans have had no impact on the strength of Colorado's health insurance market and the ability of insurers to negotiate and develop competitive products. I'd like to leave you with this thought. Only one Minnesota insurer operating in 5 southeastern counties and constituting 1% of Minnesota's current insurer market offers a copay plan, and only at the gold coverage tier. Voting yes today will help change that for the better. We can make these products widely available at all levels, with small cost increases paid only by the people who choose the products. These plans will give many patients with serious and chronic diseases, like the folks I work for, an available, predictable plan option with no impact on the health of the individual and small group markets. On behalf of the 12 advocacy and medical organizations that have endorsed this legislation, I hope you'll vote yes on it to bring this proven drug cost relief plan to all corners of the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beacon. Representative Haley, I do see your hand up. We have one public testifier. Can I come back to you after that?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Right. We will move on. Dan Andreessen, you are the last testifier that's on the list. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on House File 633. We met with Representative Bierman on this bill yesterday, and we hope to continue the dialogue as this bill moves forward. We do share the concerns with the supporters of the bill regarding high out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs, and the council has applauded steps the legislature has taken to address drug prices. In October, the first reports of the new drug price transparency law will come in to provide the state more information on the reasons for increasing drug prices to guide future policy. As we all know, pharmaceutical cost is the highest share of healthcare spending, and it continues to increase. However, we're concerned with the approach in this bill to address the problem of pharmaceutical costs and how this proposal will work with plan designs. Previous testimony referenced in the situation in Colorado, but our reading of the bill is that if these co-pays are kept flat the entire year, other plan benefits would need to change because the bill doesn't include language to lower drug prices. This could result in change of premiums, but also changing co-pays for other covered services such as higher generic co-pays or higher office visit co-pays. It appears this may lead to a creation of a platinum level product, which you will no longer find in the exchange because consumers couldn't afford these products. Dividing a deductible over a cross of a year will be a challenge because a person's healthcare needs change throughout the year and also doesn't account for fluctuations in drug prices. There's already limited plan design flexibility due to each plan needing to be compliant with the federal tool known as the actuarial value calculator, which calculates the percent of costs paid for by the health plan on average. When carriers design plans, they try to reach a broad swath of the population, creating a plan that may only be utilized by a small percentage of the population, either due to choice or inability to afford that product, and that could lead to adverse selection. This can occur when there's an imbalance in policyholders who need more health care versus those who use less. This legislation only applies to the fully insured market, and anything that implies or impacts premiums and coverage can also have the effect of pushing healthier people out of the market who do not want to pay more to self-insure. We need to keep this population in the market to balance out the costs for those who need more care. There are a lot of uncertainty in the health insurance market due to COVID and anticipated changes in federal subsidies and potential ACA changes. Adding in this requirement could create additional instability. We would urge a more thorough actuarial analysis of these plans and how they would fit into the current marketplace here in Minnesota before moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. All right, Representative Haley, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman, for bringing this forward. You and I have had a chance to talk about your proposal a number of times. So I just had a few questions for you as I'm trying to really understand it in the finer detail. And I appreciate this effort. I had a very dear friend who passed away from multiple myeloma, and that experience over 2 years, I knew very much that experience of paying, $10,000 to $12,000 in 1 month for the needed medication. So a couple of questions, Representative Bierman. You did offer this bill last session, I believe, and at that time, the requirement was that plans would offer one plan with this type of benefit, and now your bill is that it should be 25% of their offerings. I'm just wondering how you came up with the 25%. Current plan distribution, to my knowledge, gold plans equate to about 15%, silver 29%, and bronze 53%. So where does the 25% come from?
Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, thank you for the question. We continue to work on this bill this year, and through the discussions with patients and consumers who were looking at these plans, they just felt that it was important to have multiple options instead of one option per level, so that it would be some different options for them to choose from as they're shopping for that, and the weight of the plans are moving toward more and more bronze plans. So we want to make sure that we have enough selection for the consumers, and that's where the growth in the numbers per level came from.
Representative Haley.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Moving forward too, on your amendment, I was trying to understand the new requirement in your amendment that there would be a difference between those on MNsure plans and other plans outside of MNsure. Can you tell us why you included that differential in your amendment?
That just means, Bierman. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Haley. The health plans for MNsure, what this does is it's just making sure that the different aggregate types of plans are counted separately as a group, so that we keep the numbers and the requirement on each group of the health plan system intact.
Representative Haley.
Thank you. I'll have to think about that, Representative Bierman, and maybe call you offline.
Sure.
One last question. You talked a lot about the experience in Colorado. Has this been done in other states, and do you have any other input on how this has played out in other states?
So it has been done in Colorado and in Montana. I didn't really look at the Montana experience, but I did look at the Colorado plan, and in your packet today there was a letter that's from Colorado that really touted the experience out there as being positive, in that it did not raise costs in an unacceptable way for the goals that have been achieved. So that was really the model of the program that I looked at, and that's where we focused our energies, as their model, their success in both in price and the ability to reach more consumers and to help more people who are in need of this kind of available funding mechanism to afford their medications.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Haley, any further questions?
Just a final comment, Madam Chair, and thank you again, Representative Bierman, for your work on this. In the healthcare marketplace, normally what we see is if there's a change in one area of the market, that has to be, or you know, price reduction, as you're trying to do in this bill, that has to be born somewhere. And then we see price increases in another section of the market. So I do have concern that that would happen with this proposal, and maybe looking at you know, Montana, as you mentioned, or some other states could give us more experience. But that is a concern of mine, is just where do these costs ultimately then get born? Thank you, Representative Bierman. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going back to comment about the Minnesota insurers, and I think I heard about the need, there would be a need to create a platinum plan. And I'm just wondering if one of the testifiers of the bill author could speak to if that is what happened in the Colorado marketplace, and if there's any validity to that.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Representative Bierman, it looks like Mr. Bacon has a comment on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Olson. Platinum plan refers to a very specific example of actuarial value. When a consumer buys a health insurance product and there's actuarial value, it gives a rough estimate of how much of that person's cost will be paid out of their own pocket versus by the plan. And a platinum plan typically covers the most in exchange for higher premiums. I'm frankly a little puzzled by the claim that platinum plans would be needed. The first time these products were offered in the Colorado market was in 2016. So we're now 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. We're now in the sixth year of seeing these products offered in Colorado. And they've been able to offer these at the bronze plan level for actuarial value, silver and gold. There's never been a point where they've needed to offer platinum plans. And this information actually also goes to Representative Haley's concern about price increases if you're squeezing a balloon in product benefit design, if you change the structure of the copay, you're going to see other aspects of the benefit change, because at the end of the year, you need to land on a certain maximum out-of-pocket that a consumer can expect to pay and a certain actuarial value, as we described, to meet those demands. So the short answer is there's no need demonstrated to offer platinum plans, and I would be interested to see data that explains why they would be needed.
Thank you, Mr. Bacon. So we have two additional questions on the list from members, and then we will move to a vote. Representative O'Driscoll, you are up next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a little technological glitch there. Sorry for the delay. Representative Bierman, again, I would like to underscore what Representative Haley said. Thank you for bringing the concept forward. I do always appreciate looking at different options. But as Mr. Bacon came to visit with me on this, and he came to visit with me not in person but via Zoom on this process, I got to doing some contemplating on this. And then today with Ms. Tice's comments, I started chaining a few things together. I'm just wondering if you could speak to these issues. Ms. Tice had indicated that she works for an employer that provides what I think she was alluding to as maybe sort of some of the cafeteria benefits and different items. So she has some flexibility within her work plan. The other item that came to mind when she said that was, what about an FSA account, a flexible spending account? It was designed so that employees could put money into that plan with the purpose of paying for certain kinds of expenses, daycare, medical, deductibles, some of those kinds of things. And the beautiful part about that is on day one, if you are committing to put $5,000 in, you would be able to be reimbursed from your FSA for $5,000, even if you hadn't put $5,000 into that plan. And the shift for the employer on that is, if you didn't spend everything in there at the end of the year, it became employer money. And if you overspent and didn't put as much money in, the employer had to shore up the loss. Have you taken that into consideration in your contemplation of the dilemma that's before the committee today that brought forth in this bill?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for the question. What I know about people that are needing health care is that there's so many variables that affect, you know, what they can achieve, whether they can get access to health care, whether they have the means to fund a program, like you just said, if they have the $5,000 to put it in, or they have a way whereby they are able to save and sustain some of their money for the rainy day account in healthcare. You know, that does work very well for some people to have a health savings account or one of those types of things. There's a lot of people that don't have the extra money, or their employers don't offer that. So I didn't really think about that as an option in lieu of this type of a plan. I was really just focused on the patient needs from across the spectrum of what would be something that would be a little more straightforward, that people could manage and that people could utilize and have some variable choice to it. So I haven't thought about what you've mentioned, but I think for some people that might work very effectively. And I think with our healthcare system right now, I think a big part of it is we need to have more choice for people. So maybe employers that will keep that type of benefit available may be a good choice for their. And I commend her boss for, you know, thinking about his business healthcare plan picture in that way, because I think we just need more participation and helping people get the healthcare they need in such a varied marketplace that we live in.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Representative Bierman, it's almost like you and I are on the same script, because your answer to the question that I just asked leads right into my second question on here. And that is a little background. Congress passed and President Obama signed into law the ACA, sometimes referred to as Obamacare. and it allowed states to be able to have their own individual marketplace in the state, which Minnesota opted to do. And that's where we get the gold and silver and platinum and bronze plans that you're referring to, where you now would like to have 25% of those plans offering the a copay option that you're putting forth in this bill. My question is, another comment. We almost lost the individual market here in the state of Minnesota about 4 or 5 years ago. And through legislative action, and it wasn't supported by all, we put together a reinsurance program that helped to shore up that program, because we had some parts of the state that had only one option, and it was a very, very limited option for health insurance. And so we had a lot of those folks pulling out of the marketplace. What insurances in your bill is there that those people who are outside of the group that you're looking at would still have the availability of the flexibility of plan options in the marketplace if these plans were to say, you know what, we just are going to withdraw from the individual market again, or we're just not going to play in that area because we don't think actuarially we can make this work out in Minnesota? What safeguards or safety net do you have for those other folks that would be buying in the individual market if, again, as I say, the plan start saying, you know what, too big of a lift for us right now, too risky, not sure if we can make it work out actuarially, we're just going to step out of the market by serving notice. Very similar to what we had before.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bierman, response.
Really, Representative O'Driscoll, very good question. Appreciate you asking it. I think the plan that we, the bill that we came up with, number one, as we've talked about already, the experience in Colorado, number one, shows that the plan does work. And the fact that we have great insurance companies here that I know can implement it, but with some management, they have spoken to me, as he indicated, Mr. Andreessen did. He said that they would need to look at it some more and study it. We're going to have more conversations about it. But I guess my real thought about the doability of this is that we didn't put in things that other states have, who have gone ahead with this in a more advanced form of even lower copays, where they have mandated that payments would only be $150 or $250 if you look at what New Jersey has done or New York. We didn't go to that extent. We're trying to make this a patient-centered, friendly plan for insurance companies so that we wouldn't have that risk of losing insurance companies. And I think we hit a good spot in working with Senator Nelson on this in the earlier part of this year. I think we put a plan together that will work and will be manageable and will not be a heavy lift for our insurance companies.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative O'Driscoll, I will go back to you. Just want to remind folks that we have a third bill up on the agenda today. And with permission from House Info, we do have the opportunity to go over time. So please keep your comments brief so we can keep going on the agenda. Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, I don't have any other comments. I don't think I can support the bill today in the form that it's in, but I do respect the work that Representative Bierman has done. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Farr, you are last on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman, for the bill. So just a quick question when we talk patient needs and patient choices. In the bill, we're stating that new offerings have to be clearly and appropriately named to aid the purchaser. So what is a clear and appropriate name? Can you just give an example of that, what that might look like?
I think,
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Sorry, I apologize. Madam Chair and Representative Farr, I just know that if you go to a website, for instance, and you were to look it up, even the Colorado one, you would see that it would state right on there that it would be defined as a plan that would have pre-deductible co-payment listed on the plan in a way that the consumer knows what it is. So I guess it's just a You want to have it identified so as people go to shop on the marketplace, they can understand what it is. And I think that as we go forward with this and there's some advertising by the insurance companies, that we would want to have this identified. Plus in, you know, the organizations that are helping patients, I think that there might be a way that they could advise them on, you know, where to find plans that would be more suitable for their requirements and needs and ability to pay. This ultimately helps not only the patients get the medication they need to live, but it helps the insurance companies in the long run get the financial benefit of having patients on their plans and being able to afford their plans.
Representative Farr, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, and yes, Representative Bierman, I appreciate that. And the issue seems so complex to me that I still don't understand how we're going to clearly and appropriately define that for patients for their needs and choices. But I can get offline with you, and you know, it's just maybe perhaps semantics, but I don't know that really answered my question, because it's such a complex issue that I don't know how we're going to make that clear to the consumer.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Farr, and for the discussion today, members. We will move on. Representative Bierman, do you have any brief closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the committee for the great questions and listening and hearing from the testifiers. I want to thank the testifiers who came forth today, and thanks for your attention, and thanks that you will vote for the bill. This bill will help thousands of Minnesotans to better afford their lives. That's the point of this bill, and get health care to those who need it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. I will renew my motion that House File 633, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Barr.
No. O'Driscoll, no.
Thank you both. Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Daphne.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly. Representative Lislegard.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
And I will ask again, Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Thank you.
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 633, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Next on the agenda, we have House File 1183. Chair Stevenson, would you like to move and describe your bill?
Madam Chair, I will move File 1183 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy.
Good. Chair Stevenson moves that House File 1183 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Please go ahead and describe your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As we've heard already today, the high cost of prescription drugs is an incredible problem. You know, as a member of the legislature, you talk to a lot of people and you hear a lot of stories. But among the most memorable conversations are whether it happens when you're out door knocking or when you're talking to a constituent in your office, are those with the people who are struggling to afford the drugs they need to live. And I think all members here have had those conversations, and they break your heart. No one should have to choose between paying the mortgage and paying for their children's medication. No one should have to pick between skipping a meal or skipping a pill. But we know that people in Minnesota are making those decisions every day. We all know the prescription drug market is complex. And while we all wish there was one silver bullet to solve the problem, this is more of a case where we need silver buckshot. This committee has already moved substantial legislation that, if it's enacted, would help. Representative Morrison's Pharma Accountability Board, as well as Representative Bierman and Representative Liebling's bills today, they're all good steps forward. And the bill I'm presenting today is another piece of the puzzle. It addresses situations where prescription drug prices are high, not because of the free market, not because of research and development costs, but because of greed. And we've all seen the stories in the news media about bad actors raising the price of life-saving drugs by shocking amounts overnight. When a pharmaceutical company does that, when they raise the price of a drug that's been on the market for years by 500%, it isn't because it suddenly became 500% more expensive to make the drug. It's because someone realized that the people who take the drug need it to live and would pay anything to get it. That's price gouging, it's wrong, and there should be consequences. Members know that I work as a prosecutor when the legislature is not in session, and I believe in accountability, and that's what this bill is about. We're not saying that all pharmaceutical companies are bad actors, far from it. You don't need to look far to see the good work out there that pharmaceutical companies are doing. They can work miracles. But this is a case where the Spider-Man rule comes into play. With great power comes great responsibility, and a handful of bad actors are abusing that power. One last note, this isn't the first time that this legislature has considered similar legislation. Indeed, a very similar bill passed the House last biennium. This bill is a little bit different in a material way. It applies only to generic or off-patent drugs, where last year's bill applied to all drugs. That change is due to a federal court decision. I think the decision is unfortunate. I'm hoping it's reviewed and reversed, but I think this narrow approach is the best one at present, given the current legal landscape. As I said before, this isn't a silver bullet. It's one piece of the puzzle. I know we have a couple of testifiers, Madam Chair, including the Attorney General.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. With the quick note that my five-year-old would appreciate your Spider-Man reference, we can move to your testifiers. First up, we have Attorney General Keith Ellison.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. And let me thank the ranking member and all members. I'm very thrilled to be here today to provide support for House File 1183, the Generic Drugs Price Gouging Bill. And I also want to thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing forward a bill to combat price gouging of essential medications that Minnesotans rely on to stay healthy and stay alive. The ability of Minnesotans to be able to just purchase the prescription drugs that they need when necessary to support their health and their well-being without fear of some financial ruin is just fundamental to their ability to afford their lives and live with dignity and respect. Yet, skyrocketing prescription drug prices all too often threaten Minnesotans' lives and their pocketbooks. I don't have to tell you all about the story of Alex Smith. Many of you know his mother, Nicole Holt Smith. When he aged off the Affordable Care Act, he was on his own. He could not afford his insulin. He rationed it. He went into ketoacidosis, and he died. He did not die from diabetes. He died because he couldn't afford his insulin, a drug that was made and sold to University of Toronto for $1 back in the 1930s, and really for years never cost more than 20 or so dollars for a few vials, and then went up precipitously and has costed Minnesotans and others their lives. That's why I created a 15-member task force to study the ongoing problem in the prescription drug marketplace and to identify solutions that will help rein in the high cost of prescription drugs. The work of the task force culminated in an award-winning 94-page policy report, which I would like to put in the chat so you all can read it for yourselves. It's a great document. It was awarded the best government report of 2020 for its category by state officials who look at these kinds of things. So I do urge you to read it. It's an excellent report. But let me also say that the task force has 14 specific recommendations, and one of those recommendations is this bill, or a very close version of it, House File 1183, which would prohibit manufacturers from imposing excessive price increases on life-saving generic prescription drugs that they sell or cost to be sold in Minnesota. The bill reasonably provides that excessive price increases are those that exceed 15% of the wholesale acquisition cost of the drug over the preceding calendar year, and also exceed 40% of the wholesale acquisition cost of the drug over the preceding 3 years. Unfortunately, excessive price hikes and prescription drugs that far exceed the threshold set in House File 1183 are all too common and harm Minnesotans. Just to name a few of the recent examples, let me mention Daraprim. Daraprim is a very important drug. It treats HIV and toxoplasmosis. And you all know about Daraprim. Even if you don't know you know about it, you know about it. Because infamously in 2015, Turing Pharmaceutical, run by Martin Shkreli, and you probably remember that name, raised the price of off-patent Daraprim. A life-saving drug was used, like I said, for HIV patients and people with toxoplasmosis from $13.50 to $750 per pill. That's a $5,000 increase overnight. That is not the market. That is not the cost of production. That is, I have a monopoly on this, and I am going to make you pay for it, and you're going to pay for it, because if you don't, you might just die. And that ain't right. I could also mention another example, which is a generic for the Prozac drug. This one is known as Fluzatine. And in the first quarter of 2019, its price jumped from $9 to $69, an increase of 667%. And then another example is Quonfacine. It's a generic for ADHD treatment. And this drug in the first quarter of 2019, its price jumped $29 to $87, a 204% increase. And then another version of a chemotherapy drug called Vidaza. In the first quarter of 2019, its price jumped from $105 to $210, an increase of 100%. Not only does this bill prohibit these kind of excessive pricing practices in Minnesota, it adds a tool to the Attorney General's enforcement toolbox, and thereby allows our office to more effectively help Minnesotans afford the drugs that they rely on to survive. Again, these are not just any drugs, and they are generic drugs. We're not talking about brand drugs here. I think it's important to point out that this bill allows the Attorney General to be a more effective ally for consumers by providing AGO with notice of and information about the excessive price increases, authorizes the Attorney General to investigate and bring enforcement actions to remedy unlawful price increases. Importantly, House File 1183 applies only to excessive drug prices imposed by manufacturers on prescription drugs sold, dispensed, or delivered to consumers within Minnesota. So, Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, members, please consider supporting the important measure protecting Minnesotans from price gouging of the medications that they need to live. I also want to just tell you before I conclude my comments that the Minnesota Attorney General's Office is currently suing over 40 generic drug manufacturers right now for illegal price fixing. I wish I could share the complaint with you. We documented evidence where they just got together on the phone and said, you get this piece of the market, you get that piece of the market, you get that piece of the market. That's not illegal. That's not legal. That's called illegal price fixing. And we're taking them to court. This is in the generic area. So I just want you to know that we're not just proposing legislation. My office is actually bringing lawsuits against companies that are colluding to drive up prices in an illegal way. And I know there are other testifiers, so I'll yield right now and be happy to stand for any questions. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Attorney General Ellison. Next, we have Don Bernfin with SEIU. Ms. Bernfin, are you with us? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, I am Don Bernfin, and I live in Chisholm, and I am a home care worker and a parent, and I'm on the executive board of SEIU. And our union represents about 40,000 workers around the state, and on their behalf, I'm here to talk about our support for House File 1183. And my story about the high cost of drugs is my daughter's experience a couple years ago about not being able to afford her prescriptions. This was probably 2 or 3 years ago, and my daughter Emily, that spring, she started out not feeling so great, and when she called mom, of course, it sounded like she had maybe a UTI, but she also did not have health insurance, and she couldn't afford to visit a doctor, and she really became so sick that she could barely walk, and so she had to go to the ER. And they said with a couple of, you know, prescriptions, you know, she'd be okay. And so they gave her, you know, first initial shot in the ER and sent her home with some scripts. And we went to the pharmacy, and the total amount of the prescriptions it would cost for her to get better was about $375, which, you know, she didn't have. And mom did not have either. You know, she was working at Dairy Queen, making about $12.50 an hour. And mom, as a healthcare worker, didn't make much more than that. And, you know, we asked about the generic price. And I just remember that even the generic options were unaffordable. And, you know, with that first dose in the ER, you know, she felt a little better, went back to work, but without, you know, the full dose and the full, you know, run of the antibiotics and the other medicine, you know, it wasn't quite enough to cure her. So she wound up getting sicker. And so, you know, back to the ER she went, where they gave her another dose of medication in the ER, and another script that she still couldn't afford to fill. And the cycle kept repeating itself because, you know, still no insurance, still not enough money to pay for the medication. And we live in a small town up on the range. I live in Chisholm. She lives in Virginia. We have, like, a free clinic that's open, like, twice a week in the afternoons. Which normally she worked. She couldn't afford to miss work because she'd lose her job. And there's one like 20 miles away that she could go to, but, you know, we don't have public transportation in the area that goes from town to town. There's really not even public transportation that's like goes like after 5 p.m. even. So it really didn't work. You know, this went on for like almost a year. She could have, you know, she could have lost her job. She could have had, you know, permanent damage to her body. She could have wound up, you know, even dying or being unable to have children from that. And she really wound up thousands of dollars in debt from the, she wound up with one ambulance ride, several, you know, trips to the ER. Because she couldn't get a round of antibiotics and some other medications that she needed just to take care of this infection. And, you know, it's just because she didn't have access to medication at a reasonable price. You know, these weren't like orphan drugs. These were like antibiotics and, you know, some other things that she needed. You know, not opioids, not, you know, anything like that, but things she needed to, like, at the end, basically save her life. She finally did get insurance, and she finally got everything taken care of. But I just want my government to stop companies from charging desperate people, you know, as much as they can. You know, drug companies will not stop squeezing people like my daughter, you know, this, you know, 21-year-old kid, until, you know, you guys give the government the power to stop them, you know. And this is why I really urge you to support this bill, because now, you know, she's in college. She's going to have a little bit of debt from that. But she's already in debt thousands of dollars in medical bills because she couldn't afford some medication. So please, please support this bill.
Thank you, Mrs. Bernfin, for offering your daughter's story and sharing that with us today. We have two public testifiers signed up. Mr. Fjellstad with Pharma, you're back with us. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Can you see me, Madam Chair, and hear me?
Yes, we can. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Again, my name is Peter Fjellstad, Senior Director of State Policy for Pharma, a trade association for 33 biopharmaceutical manufacturers that make brand name medications that save and improve lives any day, every day. I'm here today to just express that Pharma does have concerns with House File 1183 because it attempts to implement a government price control. We also don't think that it takes the entire supply chain for medicines for patients into account, such as insurers and pharmacy benefit managers, otherwise known as PBMs, wholesalers, and government actors. We just want to reiterate that overall, prescription drug spending has increased at only 1.7% on brand name medicines in 2019, which is lower than the rate of inflation for the third year in a row. And just make sure that legislators understand that last year's prescription drug price transparency bill doesn't begin collecting information until October for a report due in January. Lastly, I'd just like to highlight the medication assistance tool, www.mat.org, for any patients having problems with affording their medicines, 950 programs from our brand name manufacturers. And in closing, Madam Chair, I'd just like to thank you and committee members for your time today. For all the reasons laid out, I just want to express that we had concerns with the bill, House File 1138. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, I have Brett Michelin with Accessible Meds on the list.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Brett Michelin with the Association for Accessible Medicines. AAM represents the manufacturers of generic and biosimilar drugs. First, I'd like to start off, and we fully agree with the author's intent, which is to reduce the cost of drugs and the cost of healthcare in the United States and in Minnesota in particular. However, going after generic drugs is, we don't believe, is the correct focus. In fact, 90% of all prescriptions filled in the United States are filled with generic drugs for only 20% of the revenue. Use of generic drugs saved Minnesota $4.5 billion in 2019 alone. And in the U.S., $313 billion. Biologics and specialty drugs, by contrast, were about 2% of all prescription drugs, yet they took 50% of the cost of the drug revenue. Use of biosimilars, as it's growing, holds great promise for reducing the cost of drugs also. Estimates from IQVIA, one of the largest data organizations collecting this type of information, projects nearly $100 billion saved by use of biosimilars by 2024. IQVIA also found in between 2014 and 2019, changes in the prices of generic drugs resulted in $7 billion of reduced revenue. On the other side of it, increases on the brand side resulted in $21 billion of increased revenue. Again, generic drugs are not driving the increases in the cost of drugs. AARP, in a study done by Dr. Stephen Schondelmeyer from Minnesota, found that generics decreased in price for 390 of the most commonly used drugs by seniors, reduced by 9.3%. The Kaiser Family Foundation, in their study of the healthcare spend, found that generic drugs are 3% of healthcare spending. Generic drugs are, in fact, the only decreasing, depreciating cost in healthcare. This bill's focus on generic drugs is just not accurately going after what is driving the increase in costs. There's a couple of the other aspects of the bill that we're concerned with. Of course, the private right of action and requiring a registered agent and an office within the state could actually increase the cost of drugs. And again, we know that's going in the wrong direction from the intent of the author. Finally, there are some severe constitutional issues, and I know the author of the bill has mentioned that, but the state of Maryland, Maryland passed this bill a couple of years ago, and it was found to be unconstitutional by the Fourth Circuit. Again, for these reasons, we would are in opposition to this bill and urge you to vote no. I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michelin. Members, I do see a few hands raised. Given that we've gone over on time, I think we're going to move right to the DE amendment and then take discussion and further testimony on Friday at our hearing. Chair Stevenson, you have an author's amendment labeled DE1. Would you like to move that and describe it now?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the DE1. It gets the bill into the shape I'd like the committee to consider it and make some of the changes we've discussed through the hearing.
Good. Members, any discussion to the DE1 amendment in order to get the bill into the shape that Chair Stevenson would like? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So, Chair Stevenson, you also have an A1 technical amendment. Would you like to move that and describe it now?
I would move the A1 amendment. As you indicated, it's a technical amendment.
Members, any discussion to this A1 technical amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Okay, that motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Lucero, you have an A2 amendment. Would you like to move that and describe it now, please?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Please go ahead and describe it.
Thank you. I actually had initially said at roll call that I was not Dick Tracy, but I'm actually going to put on my Dick Tracy super sleuth hat here because when I look at the bill, there are still some pretty terrible provisions in here that can be detected. And I draw members' attention to 4.13. A manufacturer of a generic or off-patent drug is prohibited from withdrawing that drug from sale or distribution within this state for the purpose of avoiding the prohibition on excessive price increases under Section 62J.842. Madam Chair, it is clearly not constitutional for the government to require a private company to do business. There is no authority to say, hey, private company, you do business in our state. I compel you under force of law to do business. And for this, Madam Speaker, I believe that the bill author recognizes this. And so there's Section 6, which says that this bill is severable if any of this is found to be illegal. And so this is illegal, but I want to put this to the test. Let's put our money where our mouth is. And that's why I offer the amendment to the amendment that removes the severability clause from this bill. And I ask for a green vote, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Does the bill author have any comments to the A2 amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, I'm going to ask for a no vote. Unfortunately, it sounds like Dick Tracy got bamboozled in this particular one. First of all, it's not correct to say that there's no case in which the government can compel a company to offer service. I can give you an example right off the top of my head. Utilities are not permitted to withdraw service. They have an obligation to serve anyone who wants to purchase power or gas or water or any of those utility regulated functions. So, just not true. The severability clause is pretty common in Minnesota law. In fact, the operating assumption is that Minnesota laws are severable, and if one portion is unconstitutional, the entire thing doesn't go. So I don't think it's the immense clue that Representative Lucero seems to think it is that unravels the whole mystery. And I just ask members to vote no and appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Members, any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 No.
Aye.
Aye.
And all opposed.
No.
No. No. No. No. No.
The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted.
Can I have any of us, Representative Dabney?
My apologies, Madam Chair.
Not a problem. All right. Mr. Chair, would we like to move forward and lay the bill over till Friday for further discussion?
At this point, I would modify my motion. My motion had been to re-refer it to health. And for the moment, I'll just move that the bill be laid over. And for the committee's understanding, my expectation and intention is to bring this bill up again as soon as we have some extra time in the committee to have this discussion and a final vote now that we've gotten through the amendments and the testifiers.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Chair Stevenson amends his motion that House File 1183 as amended be laid over for further discussion and at an upcoming committee hearing. And with that, we will be adjourned.